Hi, Dave Emery here. Side 2 of For the Record program number 763, The Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, Part 9, Citizen Greenwald's Financial Angel. This is being recorded on November 17th of the year 2013. We're going to plunge right in where we left off at the end of Side 1. We have been analyzing the activities of the eBay billionaire, Pierre Omidyar, last name Omidyar, reading from an article called The Extraordinary Pierre Omidyar by Mark Ames and Yasha Levine. This is on the website NSFW Corp, and it was published on November 15th of the year 2013. NSFW Corp, by the way, the website that which you can visit to find this. Capital N, S, this is all in capitals at first, capital N, capital S, capital F, capital W, that's North, South, Freedom, West, Corp, all one word. And again, this was published on November 15th of the year 2013. The article is titled, The Extraordinary Pierre Omidyar. We have been discussing Citizen Greenwald's Financial Angel, and in at the end of Side 1, we left off with a horrifying account of one of Omidyar's free market ventures, the SKS Microfinancing Company, and the closely associated Unitas Company, which was sort of a parent company. And continuing with this, as a result of the bad press this scandal caused, the Omidyar Network deleted its Unitas, that's capital UNITUS, investment from its website, nor does Omidyar boast of its investments in SKS Microfinance any longer. Meanwhile, Unitas mysteriously dissolved itself and laid off all its employees right around the time of the IPO under a cloud of suspicion that Unitas insiders made huge personal profits from the venture. Profits that, in theory, were supposed to be reinvested into expanding micro-lending for the poor. Thus spoke the profit motive. Curiously, in the aftermath of the SKS micro-lending scandal, Omidyar Network was dragged into another political scandal in India when it was revealed that Omidyar and the Ford Foundation were placing their own paid researchers into the staff of India's members of parliament. The program, called Legislative Assistance to MPs, or LAMPs, was funded with $1 million from the Omidyar Network and $855,000 from the Ford Foundation. It was shut down last year after India's Ministry of Home Affairs complained about foreign lobbying influencing India's members of parliament and promised to investigate how Omidyar-funded research for India's parliament may have been, quote, colored, unquote, by an agenda. The article then goes on to describe other similar and scandalous disasters in Omidyar Network funding of micro-lending projects in the Third World, Bangladesh in particular. And skipping down, Omidyar Network has followed the same disastrous neoliberal script in other areas of investment, particularly its investment into privatizing public schools in the U.S. and poor regions of Africa. One of the earliest Omidyar investments went to an online private charity website for needy public schools here in the United States. As David Sirota wrote, huge billionaire foundations and corporations have been holding children hostage by starving public school funding and replacing it with charity, unquote, money from the likes of the Walmart Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Broad Foundation. We can add the Omidyar Network to this list as well. Omidyar's foundation invested in the same idea, but with a Web 2.0 crowdsource twist. Donors choose, that's one word, capital D-O-N-R-S, capital C-H-O-O-S-E dot org, allows individuals to pledge amounts as small as $10 and allows school teachers to get online asking for small sums to help their classrooms. The end result, of course, is that it normalizes the continued strangling of public schools and the sense that only private funding can save education. Omidyar poured millions into donors' shoes and organized donations from other Silicon Valley donors. At first, most public school teachers didn't see the angle. Many used the resource to raise funds for their own classrooms. It wasn't until Donors Choose announced its partnership with the anti-public education film Waiting for Superman that teachers realized that they had been duped. The movie promoted the myth that education could only be saved by the likes of Tea Party-backed school reform advocate Michelle Rhee, last name R-H-E-E. Teachers organized a boycott of Donors Choose after the Omidyar-funded group announced it was essentially bribing its members with a $15 gift certificate to anyone who bought tickets for Waiting for Superman. 2 years later, Donors Choose partnered and promoted yet another right-wing teacher-bashing propaganda film, Won't Back Down. Overseas, the Omidyar Network is embarking on a school privatization program that will make Donors Choose look like Mother Teresa's handiwork. Omidyar provided seed capital for a new Africa-based for-profit school enterprise for the poor called Bridge International. In 2009, ON gave Bridge a total of $1.8 million. Matt Bannick, B-A-N-N-I-C-K, the top figure and managing partner in the Omidyar Network, sits on Bridge International's board of directors. Bridge International's first schools are being built in Kenya and are slated to expand across the sub-Sahara, hoping to rope millions of poor African kids into its schools. Bridge's strategic partner is the for-profit education giant Pearson. Diane Ravitch, R-A-V-I-T-C-H, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education and critic of school, quote, reform, unquote, efforts, has warned about Pearson's near-monopolistic power influencing the privatization of American education. By the way, as I noted in Side 1, Pearson partnered with the Bertelsmann Company by selling its Penguin imprint to Bertelsmann, basically to form the world's largest publishing firm, but Bertelsmann basically is dominating that company. It will be interesting to see if, following the Serpent Walk scenario, that, by the way, is one of the books published by the National Alliance, Glenn Greenwald, one of Glenn Greenwald's pro bono Nazi clients when he was an attorney. It will be interesting to see if Bertelsmann basically cuddles up to and eventually munches up Pearson. More about the Bridge International School Privatization Fund in Africa. The idea behind Bridge International is to provide a franchised school-in-the-box model under which each school teaches the exact same curriculum at the exact same time to every student. Teachers are given minimal training. They're merely required to teach according to the script given to them and read out to their students scripts delivered through Nook tablets. Students pay $5 a month, a lot for each student in areas as poor as sub-Saharan Africa. Currently, one new Bridge International school is opening every 2.5 days around Kenya, overtaking public education with plans to expand further. It sounds like a good idea, but the problem is that Bridge's business model has a very narrow set of supporters, namely free market think tanks, the global for-profit education industry, and proponents of a neoliberal utopia who want to defund public education and replace it with private schooling. Bridge is only a few years old, but criticism of its educational model is already piling up, even from centrist pro-business think tanks like the Brookings Institution. Even at $4 or $5 a month, Bridge's, quote, low-cost, unquote, education is too expensive for many in the developing world, forcing children to go to work and making families choose between buying food and paying for education. Naturally, food wins out, and that simply means that many children can't afford to go to school, which only increases and reinforces stratification and inequality. The fight against illiteracy requires free, quality education that's available to all children. What it doesn't need is a bunch of neoliberal techno-disruptors who want to turn education into a for-profit industry that provides schooling only to those who can afford it. And anyway, the very notion that you can squeeze enough profit from millions of the poorest children in the world to attract mega venture capital while providing quality education at the same time is absurd. That profit money is extracted from the very people Bridge is supposedly trying to help. Still think that Pierre Omidyar is a, quote, different, unquote, type of billionaire? Still convinced he's a one-of-a-kind, quote, civic-minded, unquote, idealist? Then you might want to ask yourself why Omidyar is so smitten by the ideas of an economist known as the Friedrich Hayek of Latin America. By the way, Friedrich Hayek is a disciple of Ludwig von Mises and very closely associated with the Ludwig von Mises Institute. That is an institution that is basically down with slavery, okay? We looked at that in, among other shows, for the record, 756. Continuing. The Friedrich Hayek of Latin America is Hernando de Soto, and he's been adored by everyone from Milton Friedman to Margaret Thatcher to the Koch brothers. Omidyar Network poured millions of nonprofit dollars into subsidizing his ideas, helping to put those ideas into practice in poor slums around the developing world. In February of 2011, the Omidyar Network announced a hefty $4.96 million grant to a Peru-based free market think tank, the Institute for Liberty and Democracy, or ILD. Perhaps no single investment by Omidyar more clearly reveals his orthodox neoliberal vision for the world and what constitutes civic-mindedness, unquote, than his support for the ILD and its founder and president, Hernando de Soto, whom the Omidyar Network has tapped to participate in other Omidyar-sponsored events. De Soto is a celebrity in the world of neoliberal and libertarian gurus. He and his Institute for Liberty and Democracy are credited with popularizing a free market vision of third world land reform and turning it into policy in city slums all across the developing world. Whereas land reform in countries like Peru, dominated by a tiny handful of land-owning families, used to mean land redistribution, Hernando de Soto came up with a counter-idea more amenable to the haves. Give property title to the country's poor masses so that they'd have a secure and legal title to their shanty shacks and whatever land they might claim to live on or own. De Soto's pitch essentially comes down to this. Give the poor masses a legal stake, unquote, in whatever meager property they live in, and that will unleash, unquote, their inner entrepreneurial spirit and all the national hidden capital, unquote, lying dormant beneath their shanty floors. De Soto claimed that if the poor living in Lima's vast shanty towns were given legal title ownership over their shacks, they could then use that legal title as collateral to take out microfinance loans, which would then be used to launch their micro-entrepreneurial careers. Newly created property holders would also have a stake, unquote, in the ruling political and economic system. It's the sort of camp that makes perfect sense to the Davos set, where De Soto is a star, but that has absolutely zero relevance to problems of entrenched poverty around the world. Since the Omidyar Network names property rights as one of the five areas of focus, it's no surprise that Omidyar money would eventually find its way into Hernando de Soto's free market ideas mill. In 2011, Omidyar not only gave de Soto $5 million to advance his ideas, he also tapped de Soto to serve as a judge in an Omidyar-sponsored competition for products focused on improving property rights for the poor. The more you know about Hernando de Soto, the harder it is to see Omidyar's financial backing as either idealistic or civic-minded. For one thing, de Soto is the favorite of the very same billionaire brothers who play villains to Omidyar's supposed hero, yes, the reviled Koch brothers. In 2004, the Libertarian Cato Institute, nay, the Charles Koch Foundation, awarded Hernando de Soto its biannual Milton Friedman Prize, which comes with a hefty $500,000 check for, quote, empowering the poor, unquote, and, again quoting, advancing the cause of liberty, unquote. De Soto was chosen by a prize jury consisting of such notable humanitarians as former Pinochet Labor Minister José Piñera, Vladimir Putin's economic advisor Andrei Ilyaryanov, Washington Post neoconservative columnist Ann Applebaum, FedEx's CEO Fred Smith, and Milton Friedman's wife Rosie were also on the jury. Milton was in the audience during the awards ceremony, and he heartily approved. Indeed, Hernando de Soto is de facto royalty in the world of neoliberal libertarian gurus. He's been called the Friedrich von Hayek of Latin America, not the least because Hayek launched de Soto's career as a guru more than three decades ago. Friedrich Hayek again, Friedrich von Hayek, a disciple, a protege of Ludwig von Mises, very closely associated with the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Continuing, so who is Hernando de Soto, where do his ideas come from, and why might Pierre Omidyar think him deserving of $5 million, by the way, 10 times the amount that the Koch brothers awarded him? De Soto was born into an elite white European family in Peru who fled into exile in the West following Peru's 1948 coup. His father was the secretary to the deposed president. Hernando spent most of the next 30 years in Switzerland, getting his education at elite schools, working his way up various international institutions based in Geneva, serving as the president of a Geneva-based copper cartel outfit, the International Council of Copper Exporting Countries, and working as an official in GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. De Soto didn't return to live in Peru until the end of the 1970s to oversee a new gold placer mining company he'd formed with a group of foreign investors. The mining company's profits suffered due to Peru's weak property laws and almost non-existent cultural appreciation of property title, especially among the country's poor masses. De Soto's investors pulled out of the mining venture after visiting the company's gold mines and seeing hundreds of peasants panning on the company's concessions. That experience inspired De Soto to change Peruvians' political assumptions regarding property rights. Rather than start off by trying to convince them that foreign mining firms should have exclusive rights to gold from traditionally communal Peruvian lands, De Soto came up with a clever end-around idea, giving property title to the masses of Peru's poor living in the vast shanties and shacks in the slums of Lima and the cities beyond. It was a long-term strategy to alter cultural expectations about property and ownership, thereby improving the investment climate for mining companies and other investors. The point was to align the masses' assumptions about property ownership with those of the Banana Republic's handful of rich landowning families. In 1979, De Soto organized a conference in Peru's capital Lima featuring Milton Friedman and Friedrich von Hayek as speakers and guests. At that very time, both Friedman and Hayek were serving as key advisors to General Augusto Pinochet's shock therapy program in nearby Chile, an economic experiment that combined libertarian market practices with concentration camp terror. 2 years after De Soto's successful conference in 1981, Hayek helped De Soto set up his own free market think tank in Lima, the Institute for Liberty and Democracy. The ILD became the first of a large international network of right-wing and neoliberal think tanks connected to the motherships, Cato Institute, Heritage Foundation, and Britain's Institute for Economic Affairs, Margaret Thatcher's go-to think tank. By 1983, De Soto's Institute was also receiving heavy funding from Ronald Reagan's Cold War front group, the National Endowment for Democracy, which promoted free market think tanks and programs around the world. By the end of the Reagan decade, De Soto produced his first manifesto, The Other Path, unquote, a play on the name of Peru's Maoist guerrilla group Shining Path, then fighting a bloody war for power. But whereas the Shining Path's political program called for nationalizing and redistributing property, most of which was in the hands of a few rich families, De Soto's Other Path called for maintaining property distribution as it was and legalizing its current structure by democratizing property titles, the pieces of paper with the stamps. Everyone would become a micro-oligarch and a micro-landowner under this scheme. With help and funding from U.S. and international institutions, De Soto quickly became a powerful political force behind the scenes. In 1990, De Soto insinuated himself into the inner circle of newly elected President Alberto Fujimori, who quickly turned into a brutal dictator and is currently serving a 25-year prison sentence for crimes against humanity, murder, kidnapping, and illegal wiretapping. Under De Soto's influence, Fujimori's politics suddenly changed. Almost overnight, the populist Keynesian candidate became the free market authoritarian Chino Shea he governed as. As Fujimori's top advisor, Hernando De Soto was the architect of the so-called Fuji shock therapy applied to Peru's economy. Officially, De Soto served as Fujimori's drug czar from 1990 to 1992, an unusual role for an economist given that the fact that Peru's army was fighting a brutal war with Peru's powerful cocaine drug lords. At the time, Peru was the world's largest cocaine producer. As drug czar, Hernando De Soto therefore positioned himself as the point man between Peru's military and security services, America's DEA, and drug czar under the first President Bush and Peru's President Alberto Fujimori. It's the sort of position that you want to have if you want a deep state power rather than mere ministerial power. During those first 2 years when De Soto served under Fujimori, human rights abuses were rampant. Fujimori death squads with names like Grupo Colina targeted labor unions and government critics and their families. By the way, that name, capital Grupo, capital Colina. Continuing, two of the worst massacres committed under Fujimori's reign, and for which he was later jailed, took place while De Soto served as his advisor and drug czar. The harsh free market shock therapy program that De Soto convinced Fujimori to implement resulted in mass misery for Peru. During those 2 years that De Soto served as Fujimori's advisor, real wages plunged 40%. The poverty rate rose to over 54% of the population, and the percentage of the workforce that was either unemployed or underemployed soared to 87.3%. But while the country suffered, De Soto's Institute for Liberty and Democracy, the outfit that Omidyar gave $5 million to in 2011, thrived and its staff grew to over 100 as funds poured in. A World Bank staffer who worked with the ILD described it as a kind of school for the country. Most of the important ministers, lawyers, journalists, and economists in Peru are ILD alumni, unquote. In 1992, Fujimori orchestrated a constitutional coup, disbanding Peru's Congress and courts and imposing emergency rule by decree. It was another variation of the same Pinochet blueprint. Just before Fujimori's coup, De Soto indemnified himself by officially resigning from the cabinet. However, in the weeks and months after the coup, De Soto provided crucial PR cover downplaying the coup to the foreign press. For instance, De Soto told the Los Angeles Times that the public should temper their judgment of Fujimori's coup. In the New York Times, De Soto spun the coup as willed by the people, the ultimate democratic politics. Years later, Fujimori's notorious spy chief, Vladimiro Montesinos, M-O-N-T-E-S-I-N-O-S, testified to Peru's Congress that De Soto helped to mastermind the 1992 coup. De Soto denied involvement, but in 2011, 2 years after Fujimori was jailed for crimes against humanity, De Soto joined the presidential campaign for Keiko Fujimori, the jailed dictator's daughter and leader of Fujimori's right-wing party. Keiko Fujimori ran on a platform promising to free her father from prison if she won. De Soto spent much of the campaign red-baiting her opponent as a communist. That led Peru's Nobel Prize-winning author Mario Vargas Llosa, L-L-O-S-A, to denounce De Soto as a Fujimontesonista with, quote, few democratic credentials, unquote. So in the same year that De Soto was trying to put the daughter of Peru's Pinochet in power and to spring the dictator from prison, Omidyar Network awarded him $5 million. The article goes on to talk about more of what happened in Peru under De Soto's theories, and also some similarly brutal things that happened in Cambodia as well. Skipping down, in Cambodia when De Soto's theories were put into practice. All of which begs the obvious question, if De Soto's property title program is such a proven failure in case after case, why is it so popular among the world's business and political elites? The answer is rather obvious. It offers a simple, low-cost, technocratic market solution to the problem of global poverty, a complex and costly problem that can only be alleviated by dedicating huge amounts of resources and a very different politics from the one that tells us that markets are God, markets can solve everything. Even before Omidyar committed $5 million to the dark, plutocratic idealism that De Soto represents, he was tweeting his admiration for De Soto. Brilliant dinner with Hernando De Soto. Property rights underlie and enable everything, unquote. Indeed, property rights underlie and enable everything that Omidyar wants to hear, but distract and divert from what the targets of those programs might actually need or be asking for. Which brings us back to the wonderful words written by Pierre Omidyar last month, written about Pierre Omidyar last month. Where is the proof that he's a civic-minded billionaire, a different billionaire, and an idealistic billionaire who's in it for ideals and not for profit? How is Omidyar any different from any other billionaire when he is funding the same programs and pushing the same vision for the world backed by the Kochs, Soros, Gates, and every other neoliberal billionaire? When you scratch the surface of his investments and get a sense of what sort of ideal world he'd like to make, it becomes clear that Omidyar is no different from his peers. Reading from the essay The Extraordinary Pierre Omidyar by Mark Ames and Yasha Levine, published by NSFW Corp on November 15th, 2013. By the way, two stories that I have not had time to cover. I will have these in the description for the program. Ron Paul launches new internet channel by Courtney Cohen of Newsmax. Ron Paul has a new internet TV channel. His first guest was Glenn Greenwald. Also, controversial journalist to keynote CARE LA Banquet by Global Muslim Brotherhood Watch, November 14th of 2013. The keynote speaker at CARE's LA conference was Glenn Greenwald, the CARE organization, which is represented as an Islamic civil rights organization, is actually a front for the Muslim Brotherhood. This concludes For the Record program number 763, The Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, Part 9, Citizen Greenwald's Financial Angel, being recorded on November 17th of the year 2013. My name's Dave Emery. Ciao.